Michael in it for a cupcake?
Oh, yes, of course, Michael.
Yes. Okay.
Michael, sorry about this.
All right, no problem. Okay, so IFRIC update. Agenda paper 12, and this is from the September IFRIC meeting. There are just three items that I wanted to highlight for you today. First is the item on pages 3 and 4 relating to IFRIC 14. Now, I know I've highlighted this to you before. Just wanted to... And this is to do with clarifying the circumstances in which an asset can be recognised on the balance sheet in respect of a defined benefit pension plan which has a surplus, and in particular clarifying, and it's in subparagraph A on page 4, about a circumstance in which an asset shouldn't be recognised, and that is when a third party, for example a plan trustee, has a unilateral right to use the surplus for other purposes. In addition to that, the Interpretations Committee is proposing that it also clarifies, and this is from subparagraph D, just some of the presentation points relating to this. And there's one final sort of sweep issue that we'll be taking to the Interpretations Committee meeting in November connected with this, and so we'd expect to bring you the proposals from the Interpretations Committee either at the December or the January board meetings to seek your agreement for exposing these amendments. The other couple of issues I wanted to comment on. There were five tentative agenda decisions that the Interpretations Committee published in the IFRIC update. One of these on the bottom of page 6, top of page 7, relating to the assessment of significant influence by a fund manager. Now, this is looking at a circumstance where a fund manager has gone through the process in IFRS 10 of assessing whether it is an agent on behalf of other investors in that fund, and appropriately concluded that it is an agent and therefore appropriately it does not consolidate that fund. And then the sort of the follow-on question, which was the issue submitted to the Interpretations Committee, is okay, once it's gone through that process, is it required to assess whether or not it has significant influence, in particular looking at a circumstance where the fund manager has its own investment in the fund as well, and if so, how should it make that assessment? Now, the Interpretations Committee, in looking at this, observed that the fund manager would be required to make an assessment as to whether it's got significant influence, but it also observed that IAS 28 doesn't give any specific guidance about the role that those powers that the fund manager exercises in its capacity as agent, whether those should or should not be taken into consideration when making this assessment about whether it has significant influence. And so as part of the tentative agenda decision here, the committee is observing that this is a broader issue, that it thinks that the ISB should look at as part of a broader issue on the equity method of accounting. So this is just tentative, so there will be comments coming back, and we'll see what those are as to how to finalise it. I've noticed two board members raising cards at this stage. Mary?
Well, on that one, I had noted a concern about the idea of waiting for our research project on the equity method, because when I look at this issue, the fact pattern of fund manager concluding that it is an agent but also having some interest in the fund seems to me to be a not unusual situation, so that this determination of whether you do or you don't include the powers that you have as agent in assessing significant influence seems to be one that is being made relatively frequently, at least in that industry, in practice. And I thought that it, even though it is a relatively broad issue, I was wondering whether we should encourage the Interpretation Committee to look at that issue, maybe, you know, as an interpretation. I guess I was interested from either you or from board members who are at the interpretation committee, why they thought that they prefer to let diversity in practice sit for what I think has got to be at least 5 or 6 more years.
Do you want me to comment on that? My takeaway of the discussion was that, firstly, the question came up, I think, because people were trying to work out whether IFRS 10 had relevance because of the specific discussion it has on principal versus agent. So did that change anything? So I think the first thing that came out of the discussion was really you shouldn't sort of be influenced by Watson 10 to change the way you were applying 28 before. So I think the reason why they didn't go then further was because the answer isn't really there to interpret. IS 28 is silent on the issue, whereas IFRS 10 makes a big deal about agent versus principal and what the consequences, and also makes a distinction between having power and control, which isn't brought out so much in IS 28. So I don't think they felt they had what they needed to provide an interpretation, would be my assessment.
Although I'd come back on that and say, you know, from the beginning, the point about the interpretation committee as opposed to the old SIC was that it could step in not just when there was, there was a hook to interpret, but also if there was not guidance and an issue needed guidance provided. You know, that the commentary that you offered might have a bearing on how much they looked at, you know, these words or not, but I would be concerned with them stepping in and making a comment without due process, and let's say in terms of an agenda decision, I wouldn't be concerned with them stepping in, you know, to address a void if they did it with their, you know, normal process of either an interpretation or an amendment.
I think just following on from Sue's comments, the agency guidance in IFRS 10 I see as being very much grounded in the definition of control that is used in IFRS 10. And so we didn't see that there was a possibility of even sort of analogizing to that guidance, because the assessment of significant influence is based on quite a different assessment compared with the control assessment within 10.
But I'm not arguing for a particular outcome. I'm just saying that this seems to me to be a pervasive practice issue today. And the decision that they've reached would either everybody's doing it one way right now and there's a concern that that's not good information, which would seem to need some standard setting to change, or there is diversity in practice right now and saying we're going to wait for the equity method project is saying, and we're willing to live with pervasive diversity for 5 or 6 years.
I don't think that was so much the issue, though, was it?
I think the issue, if I understood, is that you may have a holding in the fund in addition to being an agent, and that holding may give you significant influence easier than you do equity accounting. If that holding is not sufficient, you have to look at whether, as an agent, you can say, I don't have control, and I don't consolidate, but as an agent, I have influence. Is that compatible with the notion of being an agent? Can we be both an agent and have influence? Seems difficult. And this is where the committee seems to be saying that we don't have a basis in the definition of the agency relationship in IFRS 10 to conclude on that point.
And that's certainly part of the conceptual discussion that would need to be had there, whether you could say, okay, I'm allowed to, or I'm required to ignore these powers that I have under IFRS 10, but would it be appropriate to ignore, or should I include these powers under my IS 28 assessment?
And all I'm, again, all I'm saying is, shouldn't we be pushing them to work through that process and come out and say this is where the standards leave you, or if the standards leave you in a void without any guidance, then developing guidance that goes through due process so people can, you know, comment and provide input about whether we think we're landing in the right place.
What I can't remember, Michael, is whether there was an issue with diversity as such, or whether it was a more a question of should we be looking to IFRS 10 or not. And we said don't worry about IFRS 10, because I'm not sure that there was a big diversity problem.
Yes. And that's where my concern is grounded, is if there is diversity.
I don't understand why this matters and why we're discussing it, because doesn't equity accounting for holding in a fund give you the same answer as fair valuing a holding in a fund?
There's potentially there's going to be a lot of
when wouldn't it?
IFRS 9 is certainly the same. IS 49, you may have the problem of impairment of certain lines of equities.
Yeah.
That you don't have with the first night. It's transitory. It's
the
problem is it's just been reduced.
I mean, is it disclosure difference or what?
It could be different, couldn't it? The measurement of the equity accounting.
Technically, the measurements are
different. I mean, the right answer is fair
right.
value.
It's
the thing should just be a
fair
value.
It's the same in that it's one line item, but the measurement's different.
But is it different? It's share of net assets, and if those net assets are at fair value, which they will be in a fund, you get the same answer.
And hopefully you have no transactions to eliminate.
Yeah, and you'd also potentially trigger different disclosure requirements, sort of IFRS 7 versus IFRS 12 and so on.
Okay. Now that we have reduced the problem, I suggest you move to the next.
Okay. Well, the last item was item bottom of page 7, top of page 8, which is it's headed up IFRIC 21 levies, but it isn't really about the levies as such. It's about the cost associated with the levies, and about the question was how should the cost of a levy be accounted for in terms of, is it an administrative cost or inventory or part of property, plant and equipment potentially. Now this was an area that when the Interpretations Committee had been developing IFRIC 21, it had decided that it wasn't something that it could develop a general principle on, so therefore IFRIC 21 only focuses on the liability accounting side. This issue coming in now, the committee felt that, you know, consistent with that observation, that it felt it would be unlikely to be able to reach consensus on how the debit side of the transaction should be accounted for, either in the particular cases submitted or as a sort of a more general, broader sense. But it did note that this was really related to perhaps an underlying tension between the notion of matching costs with revenues and the definition of an asset, and so asked that we relay the concerns that had arisen here in this issue to the conceptual framework team, which we have done so. So those were the three items I wanted to highlight for you, but happy to take questions on any other points as well.
I think the last issue, actually the tension of matching cost with revenue is the big issue. And your staff is going to provide a short summary. And what is the time frame do you have in your mind?
It was just a case of just preparing a short note for the team that's working on conceptual framework. They've done that, and they've drawn the issue to the attention of the conceptual framework team, together with both the detail of what was in the paper as well, really for consideration within that project.
Because we have a comprehensive standard of revenue, but we don't have a comprehensive standard of the cost. And after implementation of the revenue, there might be a lot of issues like this issue of IFRIC 21, because revenue is clear, but cost is not clear. So therefore, that causes a divergence. So then if you look at the issue, then IFRS 15 may be clearer, but because we are not clear with the cost, so then we should address something about the cost. Then question is, shall we tackle the comprehensive standard like IFRS about the cost?
Well, I'm not sure that we're hearing about a lot of concerns about general sort of cost treatment. I mean, IS2, you know, we really get questions in related to IS2, and you know, so far we've got very little in the way of cost of sales type questions in. This really is the first in my knowledge that's come to the Interpretations Committee in this area. So I don't see it as being an area that we need to be focusing on in the near term anyway.
Do you have any update to put it into the agenda consultation?
We've not heard much in the way of concerns, so you know, I don't see that as being a candidate for inclusion in it.
I just had one question, Michael. I don't want to go into a lot of detail on this, but it's with respect to the IFRS 13 fair value measurement issue. And based on the summary here, it says that the committee decided not to take any further action, amendment, or put it on its agenda on the basis that the words in IFRS 13 already provide adequate guidance. But if you're a reporting entity and you subscribe to a third-party pricing service, let's say for loans, and you get a range of prices, and now you, as the investment committee, the CIO, has to pick a point estimate on a spectrum, isn't that process of going through and making an adjustment to the valuation, if let's say you're not given a point estimate, but you have to exercise your judgment now, isn't that essentially something that would affect the classification of the hierarchy? And so the third-party pricing service may have used all, in theory, level one inputs, but the outcome that went through a model requires judgment to kind of decide where on the continuum you decide to peg the point estimate.
I think that's true. I think my main takeaway from the discussion at the Interpretations Committee was really you need to understand how that number's been arrived at. So is it as simple as having looked at quoted prices, how big have the adjustments been and how significant are they to the value, just to decide where on the hierarchy you fall. So I think that sort of information you've just gone through, there would be one of the things you'd need to consider, and it may well result in you going to a level two or a level three. But I think the point is you can't just say, given the label of the type of valuation you've used, that determines where you are on the hierarchy. You need to know the basis for the underlying measurement.
It isn't level one just because you got it from a third party.
Exactly.
No, I understand. And the next question I had was, it's not necessarily level one also because the third party used all level one inputs. Because if you're going to adjust the output of their, you know, service to you, in other words, they provided you with a range of values to something. I mean, to my mind, if a third-party pricing service is just going to quote you, this is what it traded on a particular day, and that's level one, you could look it up yourself. But typically, a third-party pricing service is doing something more than that. And I thought that any type of judgment that would be exercised to pick a point estimate when given a range would essentially automatically put it in a level three category. And I don't know whether you got into that level of discussion, but.
Well, Sunny, I think similar to what Sue mentioned, I took away from this that you need to understand what that third-party pricing service has done to the inputs in order to then make your judgment as to what level in the hierarchy the price is.
Michael, any other?
That's everything for me.